Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Make Sense with Mental Leap, the show that places power in your hands and information for your mind. Let others leave small lines, but not you. Let others place their future in someone else's hands, but if you listen to the show, you'll make sure it's not you. We'll provide you with the keys, but it's up to you to unlock the door.
Welcome to Make Sense with Mental Leak. We're going to get right into the show tonight. Tonight we're talking about a life worth living with my guest, Andre
Joaquin.
And we're mixing it in with another topic that me and Andre discussed called From Malehood to Manhood. And Andre has quite the story. A lot of us young black men think that because we went down a certain path, there's no hope for us. And I want you to understand that no matter where you are at in life, if you're breathing, you can make the change. You can become your best self. You can become the person that you choose to be. There is no excuse. Whatever roadblock may be in your way, no matter what you've gone through, somebody has had worse. And actually, there's somebody who has had worse that has succeeded in life. They've done something. That doesn't mean it won't be obstacles. So with that being said, Andre, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
Man, thank you for being on the show. So talk a little bit about your educational background, and then we'll get into your story. So right now, you're a first-year doctoral student.
Correct. First-year doctoral student at Northern Illinois University in the Counseling and Education, and Supervision Program.
Okay. And you have your master's in
mental health counseling.
Okay. And you're a part of like every association, right? Very involved.
A little bit, quite a few.
Right, right. Why is that? Why do you feel you need to be involved?
I think if you look at the overall context of everything that goes on in society, and we always wait for someone to step up, we always say, yeah, you know, someone needs to do something. I believe by being an active part of these organizations, I am doing something. I'm contributing. I'm giving back to society. And so, you know, not only that, I have a passion to help out certain populations that go marginalized, ostracized in our community, that are often just looked down upon.
Right.
So I feel like, you know, it's my role, it's my duty to bring light or give light to certain things that's going on in society. Okay. You know, not only talk the talk, but walk the walk as well.
Right. Now, you have a story that people will say is very interesting, right? The picture of somebody making it is this person who always tried and was always on the straight and narrow. And we understand that life may throw a few curveballs at you, or because you come from a certain path doesn't mean you can't jump on another path, right? People will judge you and say, well, you went to prison, and then leave you right there. And people say, look, that person is no good. We do it to people all the time.
Right.
When that happened to you, what made you say, no, I still can make it. I still can do it.
Well, to be honest, you know, when I think about that saying, it takes a village to raise a child. Sometimes it takes a village to raise a man or bring a man into being. And, you know, and I was lucky enough to be surrounded by the right support system, not because it found me, but I found them and they embraced me regardless and despite my past.
Right. So when you're ready to learn, the teacher will appear. So let's talk about your past. You come from Trinidad, correct?
Yeah, well, I was born in Brooklyn.
Okay.
But right after my birth, my mother sent me to Trinidad to live with my father. Mm-hmm. So the first 4 years of my life, I grew up in Trinidad and Tobago with my father and with my stepmother. And that's all I knew. That's who I knew. You know, as far as my birth mother, I did not know her. And when she arrived, you know, I kind of like, you know, didn't know who she was and whatnot. So when she came and she introduced herself, and next thing you know, I was with my brother, and, you know, I looked up to my big brother. So wherever he went, I went. So when I turned around and I knew it, next thing you knew, I was here in America and I was with my brother, you know, with a woman I did not know. So, you know, it was kind of a traumatic experience for me. And what happened after that, it was, you know, it was pretty hard and arduous. You know, I can remember a childhood in Trinidad where I wasn't abused, where I wasn't loved, and, you know, where I was loved and, you know, taken care of. And, you know, when I came up here, it was very different because, you know, my biological mother, it was a lot of instances of abuse and whatnot. So, you know, when I was the first years of my life in America, all I can remember, you know, yeah, there were good times, but I remember those times of abuse, and it kind of shaped and, you know, had an effect on me, you know, not being able to voice or say the things I want to say because I was too scared to say these things and whatnot. So, you know, while some people face arduous circumstances, those were my arduous circumstances. Those were my rough times of passage. So I say from 4 to 15 years old, I was, you know, abused by my mother, by my older brother at times, my oldest brother, not my older brother, my oldest brother. And just kind of forced to go with this because at the time, the school system, I can remember going to school and whatnot, and I would have welts on my face and welts on my arms, and the teachers wouldn't say anything. You know, the teachers would look and they were often ignored. No one would ask questions. It was like, don't ask, don't tell. You know, so I carried these psychological scars growing up, and it took a toll on me, you know. And that the price of that was I became aggressive. I became hostile. I can remember just at 10 years old thinking that I did not want to live, that life was not worth living. So I would rather die. I would just dream and fantasize of ways that how someone or something may take my life just because I felt like there was no hope. Yeah. And what ended up happening was, you know, I was like, you know, at 14, I was sent to California, you know, passed back to Chicago, well, to Joliet, then sent back to Trinidad, then from Trinidad back up here where I started hanging around the gangs and whatnot. I ended up coming here. When I came back, I remember a situation with my mother. She was, she just decided to beat me with a belt again. And by the time, you know, I had snapped in my head, like, man, this is enough. Enough is enough. So I grabbed it. I was like, no, never again. You need to stop. This is, you know, it's not going to happen anymore. Put down the belt, grab a broom, and start hitting me with a broom. And I take the broom. I'm like, no. So what did my mother do? She's like, leave, get out. So, you know, basically kicked me out. So now I'm out on the street, staying in no hallways, staying in basements, staying in abandoned things. So, you know, what happens, you know, the guy who's got all the money in the hood is like, hey, what's up? You need a place to stay? And I'm like, yeah. You know, are you hungry? Yeah. He feeds me, you know, takes me out shopping, then turns around and gets me a hotel and a place to stay, and it's warm. Then tells me, well, you know, I can't really do this for you long term. This is just, you know, so you can get a few nights off the street. Hey, how would you like to make some money? And I'm like, yeah. So, you know, he introduces me to selling drugs and teaches me how to sell drugs. He's like, this is how you're going to be able to take care of yourself. Meanwhile, you know, I'm still out on the street hanging out with gangs, with, you know, deviant peers, everyone who's doing the wrong thing and, you know, saying the wrong things and just out there surviving. Some people are just scrambling to survive. And we all rely on each other for that sense of family, that sense of hope when, you know, it's really a hopeless situation because we're doing all the wrong things that's going to take us down the wrong path. And when I mean the wrong path, I mean to prison and death and everything like that, you know. And then I got locked up at 15 for shooting someone, and I can remember going to jail, and I had some money on me from selling drugs, and my lawyer asked me, he was like, yeah, too bad you didn't have any money, you could have paid me. I was like, well, I got $500. She's like, I'll take it, and got me a deal and got me right back out on the street within 2 months for shooting someone. Yeah, that was wild, and it's wild when about it now, because, you know, I can't believe, like, you know, where my life is now, where my life was then. You know, it's almost like I'm living in a dream, and I'm looking back at myself like, wow, did this really even happen? Am I making this stuff up? Nah, you can't make this up. This is reality. And so now I'm back on the street, and I'm hanging with friends, doing the same friends I was hanging out with, which was, you know, everybody from my gangs and whatnot. And, you know, I was a gangster disciple. So I was hanging around with all the other gangster disciples, gang banging and doing everything we do, selling drugs, drive-bys, gang banging, fighting, whatever. And then I got caught up for armed robbery.
How old were you?
I was just turned 16, so I was like, you know, a few months after my 16th birthday. And I remember getting caught up in the system then, getting a public defender who never came and saw me. He probably saw me twice the whole time, like one time in the middle of me getting a bond and one time because I messed up. Once I got out on bond, I got out on house arrest. I messed up on house arrest. I got locked right back up. And then, what was it? I saw him like right before trial. Didn't tell me like, well, if this is what you're looking at, this is what I can get you. He was just telling me, you know what? This is the best thing to do is take a bench trial. If I was you, I would take a bench trial. You know, he didn't tell me what the differences was. He didn't explain to me. So I trusted him. I was like, okay, I'll take a bench trial. And, you know, me and my friend, we ended up getting 6 years. And, you know, I can remember 16, turning 17 in the county jail. And they're waiting for us. They're waiting for me to turn 17 to sentence me, so I can go to prison and not to juvenile. Yeah.
What the hell? Looking back at that,
mm-hmm.
Did anybody in the system ever say, what did this kid go through? What did this young man experience to get him to this point?
No. No one looked at that. No one ask questions or anything like that. It was just, you know, everything was just like, here's this kid. He's bad. Lock him up. And one of the things that went against me is that I had a brother who was a GD that was, you know, a high-ranking member of the GDs out in Joliet. And because I'm associated as his little brother, I was deemed just as worse or just as bad as him. So they did everything to get him off the street. So now they got his little brother off the street. And when I went to prison, I went to real prison, you know. And I can even remember some of the situations that happened in prison that kind of changed my life and changed my perspective. Because when I got locked up, I was thinking like, man, I need to start doing right because, you know, I can't go through all this stuff and continue to go through this. I need to straighten my life up. And these were the thoughts that was in my head when I first went to prison. Then when they sent me to prison and I ended up in one of the prisons, you know, and I remember it was like a very nice prison, but even in a nice prison, there are dangers. And someone befriended me and, you know, I was only like 135 pounds soaking wet. And someone befriended me and, you know, I gravitated to this person because he wasn't in a gang. And then that's when I found out how much I needed the gang because that's when this person turned on me and was like, hey, you know what I'm saying? Basically, this is how it's going to go. I looked out for you. Now you're going to go ahead and basically be my girl. And of course, I was like, hell no.
You weren't going, right?
I'm not going. So, you know, that's when I yelled out like, hey, I'm a GD. And then I had to rely on the same people that I was trying to get away from to protect me and carry me through. And when I saw I needed that, it kind of delved me into, you know, being in a gang even more. It was almost like I embraced criminal university because that's what, you know, prison was like. You know, you're hearing everybody tell their stories and whatnot. And these are like, I'm 17 years old and I'm soaking up all these different bits and pieces from all these different guys from different walks of life who was like armed robbing, who was selling drugs, who was doing shootings and who was doing this. And I'm picking up bits and pieces and learning from them and learning how I want to fashion my life when I get out of prison. So it's already being instilled in me.
So you're learning how to be a better criminal.
Yeah, I'm learning how to be a better, ferocious criminal, you know, because, like, the more I'm in there is the more I'm seeing the corruption, even the corruption in the gang and whatnot. So it's making me more hardened. It's making me more, you could say, ornery. So, you know, I'm acting and I'm becoming at the same time. You know, and so when I get out of prison, now fast forward, I get out of prison and then I'm out there and I'm out and about. So, you know, now I'm even more like more criminal minded, more criminal thinking about ways to go ahead and get money. So I start back selling drugs. And at the same time, I'm still gang banging a little bit. But, you know, I'm doing whatever I can to survive at the same time. But inherently, I still, you know, even though I grew up in an abusive household, my mom instilled in me certain morals and values and principles that I still carry with me to this day. Like, you know, you always respect hardworking people and whatnot. So even in the midst of me doing some of the crimes and everything that I was doing, I still kept those morals and principles in my heart. So when it came time to do something against someone or do something against a whole family or something like that, I'm like, nah, I'm not with that. Or, you know, just taking money out the mouth of someone, they're hardworking people. So I'm not going to do that, you know, cause I was taught better than that, you know, despite the things that I went through, I knew I was taught like how to be a good person.
Right.
But, you know, maybe wasn't taught in the most precise manner, because just thinking back, you know, I was being raised by someone who was abusive, but was also abused growing up herself. So she knew nothing but how to be authoritarian, and, you know, and she believed, you know, a lot of Trinidadian people believe spirit of rod spoil the child. So whatever it is she deems that I did wrong, it would be, you know, what we call licks.
So licks. So let's talk about you transitioning from prison back to society. At what age were you when you got out?
I was 19 when I got out.
Okay. And then you went back to Joliet?
I went back to Joliet, to the streets of Joliet. And like I said, I started gang banging and whatnot, and started hanging out, started selling drugs. Then I got caught up for having guns, because, you know, at the time I felt like it was better to get caught with the gun than to get caught without it. And I was selling drugs because I felt like this is what I needed to do to take care of myself. And I was selling drugs to get by, you know, tried working a little job, but it really wasn't paying that much on minimum wage. So I started back selling drugs. And then I got caught up and I went back to prison. Then, of course, again, I'm back in there like 21 or so. Or matter of fact, I think I went back in before my 21st birthday. I did go back in before my 21st. So I was 20 when I went back. Got out at 19, went back at 20.
So you don't have a GED or nothing by this time?
You know what? That's one thing I did have. I did get a GED, because one thing about being raised in a Trinidadian household, that they're strictly enforced education by any means, you know, whether you're, you know, being disciplined, however, you're going to learn and you're going to be educated by the end of the day. So I was pretty smart when I went in there. GED was nothing for me. I went in there after about 3 months. I studied for it, passed it, and, like, you know, passed it at the, like, 89th percentile, you know, and got my GED, but I really didn't have any guidance or anything or anyone to, like, you know, well, hey, you know, this is what you should do, or this is what you would be good at, because they really didn't have career counselors in prison that kind of tell you that, okay, maybe you might find this interesting to do this and do that. You know, they didn't have anyone like that, you know. So what I do, I just hung out, play cards and gang bang and did whatever, drink hooch, gamble, whatever. So
you're back in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you begin to transform in prison, or was it when you got out again?
No. Actually, I don't transform. I get worse, because, you know, now I'm thinking, okay, I was on the right path, and my criminal thinking has me thinking like, okay, what I need to do, I need to stop gang banging, I need to start concentrating on selling drugs. So I, you know, start, you know, learning again, going to criminal university, hanging with all the ballers and all the guys who are calling shots and whatnot. And, you know, I continue on, you know, in that education from the streets within the prison. So, you know, of course, I'm taking little courses just to get by and whatnot, but I'm not really interested. I'm interested in selling drugs and whatnot. So I get out and I start back selling drugs again, because who embraces me? The streets embrace me. No one's like, okay, here's this resource for you. You know, they give you resources, and the resources they give you when you get out doesn't really amount to anything. So you get out, you do some of these programs, and it's just to make the government feel good that they're doing something,
right.
You know, and the resources they send you might as well just be
nothing.
going in line and walking around the block and going back out. So, you know, now I'm out. And I started back selling drugs, started hanging around, still hanging around fellow members of Disciples. But now I've learned my lesson. You know, there's no future in gangbanging. So I started hanging around other gang members and from other different gangs. And I start, you know, networking. And I start, you know, building up a more criminal network and start, you know, doing these things. And what happens this time again? I get caught up for guns. And because I didn't have any pro-social skills, I got caught up for aggravated battery because someone said something derogatory to my girl at the time. And they said something that was racially offensive. So, you know, I kind of felt it was my duty to pick up for her, and I punched him, and boom, I get locked up again. So I do my time. I get out. And this time I get out, you know, you would think that I learned my lesson after three times, but no, I did not learn my lesson. I go back and I start back selling drugs. So this is what I know now. This has become my life and my routine. Even though I know there's a risk, you know, I think that I'm going to be a smarter criminal. And I start back selling drugs, and I ended up getting someone pregnant. And it was just like an uncertainty that if the baby was mine, because, you know, there's men in my family who don't have children, and, you know, we suspect they can't have children. So I just thought I was one of them. And so when the test came back, the day I found out that he was mine for certain, I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? It was the day, same day I found out I had another son on the way. And I was just like, wow, you know, I need to do something. But though I was still caught up in that lifestyle, that mentality, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go, who to turn to, or what. So I was like, okay, maybe after I get through selling this set of drugs that I got right now, then I'll stop, reevaluate everything, and maybe do something, look at doing something different. And about an hour after I made that statement, I got raided. So I ended up catching this case, and then I'm reevaluating and negotiating everything. But I didn't stop there. So I ended up getting into it with the person that I was getting drugs from. So we had a very bad negotiation, and it went bad for him because, you know, I basically kidnapped him and told him that he can't go anywhere until I get my money. And then we kind of both concocted a plan and to get money from his supplier. And the supplier, you know, it did not go down as planned. His supplier decided that he's going to call the police. And they called the police, and then everything went, and I went my way and he went his way, and I ended up going on the run because I had this warrant out now. And so when I had this warrant out, I ended up going from Texas to Nevada, California. And during that time, I connected with my son's mother, because she ended up having two drug cases too. The one that was pregnant at the time when we got caught. And so we stayed in Colorado for a while. And while I was in Colorado, that's when it kind of, you know, like all while I was on the run, I was like, I need to do something different. I started acting different. I started walking different. I started talking different. You know, and, you know, for a little bit, I started fooling myself like, man, I might be able to just walk away from everything, just start a whole new life. because, like, it was for the first time I would walk down the street and police wouldn't harass me. For the first time, you know, I would be the person that's driving and the police would pull up next to me and wouldn't even look at me because of how I dress and how I carried myself and whatnot, you know. So I wasn't doing anything, so I had no reason to be suspicious. And, you know, when I thought that, you know, I was fooling myself and everything, I still decided to go. Like, my son's mother was like, you know, I want you to be a different person. If not for me, for the next person, you know, because you can't, you carry around with so much baggage. And what she meant by baggage was so much like hurt from my trauma and my past trauma and everything. And she noticed the way that I looked at life was differently and not really normal with the way the rest of society looked at things. So I started going to counseling while I was on the run because I wanted to change. I didn't want to be that person. And I wanted different for my, I wanted something different for my son. So for both of them. So what ended up happening is we eventually got caught. And when I went to prison, I mean, when I got locked up, I was facing all this time and whatnot. And I can remember the day the U.S. Marshals caught me. And I was like, my life is over with. And he was like, you know what? There's light at the end of the tunnel. He said, you know, he's just like, that always stuck with me. There's light at the end of the tunnel. And when he told me that, it was this calm that came over me. And even though I went to jail and I'm facing, like, you know, 35 years in prison and whatnot, 85%, you know, the same person who used to abuse me was the same person that ended up taking care of me because, like, she saw something. She saw she didn't want me to go to prison for the rest of my life. She didn't want me to pay for that because even through my time in prison and whatnot, you know, she finally came and made amends, and that helped me kind of move on, you know, and stop having that hate and everything like that. So, you know, when I found out I had my sons for the first time, like I had my one son and I had another son on the way, that was the first time I felt like life was worth living. And it changed my life having two sons and thinking to myself, well, I don't want this to be their life. I don't want them to grow up gang banging. I don't want them to face the same experiences that I face. I don't want to be the one, because I've seen this many a times where the father and the son is in prison together. And I didn't want that for my sons. Matter of fact, I've seen it where the grandfather, the father, and the son is in prison, you know, and I sure didn't want that for any future generations, any of my family members or anything. So, you know, that I would say my sons were the motivating factor that caused me to want to change my life. So now, you know, when I got that time, you know, it was like, it was almost symbolic because I went, this time I went to jail and I didn't claim anything. I didn't claim that I was GD or anything like that. I remember they put me on a prison deck with where it was nothing but vice lords and stones in Rockford. And in Rockford, they were, it was gang banging all the time. So they put me on this deck with all these vice lords and stones. And like a couple of them knew me from the street and they were like, yeah, he's GD. And I was like, man, I'm not with that. You know, I'm not even on that anymore. And it just so happens that the guy who's the most violent one embraced me. And, you know, he got everyone to see that, you know, like, man, you know, just because he was one doesn't mean he's one anymore. So, you know, it kind of, I was like protected for some reason. And, you know, for me, that's my spirituality. That's God. God was taking care of me because he saw I wanted to change. He saw I wanted to change in my heart. So when it came time and they looked at the overall evidence and whatnot, and the guy, he did not want to press any charges, and he was unwilling. He was not trying to cooperate because, you know, like I said, we made a deal, you know, at the end, like to work together. So, you know, he was just like, well, you know, I'm not pressing any charges. I'm not coming to testify. They end up dropping the kidnapping and all that. And it just sends me on the drug case to like 7.5 years. You know, I can even remember my lawyer's name was Glenn Jazowicz. He said, you know, when it came down to 15 years and he's like, man, we can do better. Then it came down to 12 years. I was like, let's take that. He's like, no, we can do better than that. Then we came down to 10 years. He's like, I think we can do a little bit better. I was like, man, are you sure? He's like, yeah. And then he's like, well, they're down to 8 years. Are you ready? I was like, man, I think we could do better. And, you know, he thought I was crazy. But really, it was like my spirit telling me, like, man, everything is going to be okay. And so they ended up taking an extra 6 months off. So it was, I got 7.5 years. But this time when I went back, I was like, things are going to be different. Because I got 2 sons. I got to be a role model. I got to do what's right. So I started doing what was right in prison. And what I mean by doing right, I started getting educated. I started reading books because, yeah, I got my GED, but what the hell is a GED?
Right.
There's nothing in society right now. It's a stepping stone. You know, it's a little toe in the doorway, you know what I'm saying, when you're trying to get it open, but it's not really going to do anything. There's no real force behind it. So you can't open the door. So I started taking college classes and whatnot. And while I was in there, one of the teachers said, wow, you really have pretty good writing skills. And I teach on the outside. And if you were one of my kids on the outside, and I'm 30 something now, and she's calling me a kid. She's like, if you was one of my kids on the outside, I'd have gave you an A or a B for this work. Because you're doing college level work. So that right there kind of like gave me a little momentum to stay in school. So I started educating myself while I was in there and getting educated and focusing on trying to do something better. So while I was in there, I, you know, took college level classes. I accumulated like maybe about 80 credit hours. Then when I got out of prison, I was like, well, okay, I'll try to find a job. I couldn't find a job. Why? Because I had the skin condition, vitiligo. So it kind of looks like almost like a contagious disease, you know, to some people who do not know about it. And so trying to get a job, whether it's a fast food restaurants were like, oh, okay, yeah, thank you, and keep it moving. But they can use my background against me. They don't have to use the vitiligo, what they see.
Right.
So, you know, I was just like, you know what? And then I also had lupus, so I couldn't lift a lot of heavy stuff. So I was going through a lot of, pains with lupus. So I couldn't work at warehouses like other people. I worked 2 days and I would be off for 5 days because I couldn't take the pain that was going on with my lupus. So I was like, you know what? I got all these credit hours, you know, I already signed up for school. I signed up for school even before I got out. I was like, you know what? Let me see what I can do with these credits that I got, because I'm not that far from getting my associates. So I thought, and when I went to JJC, they gave me 12 credit hours for like around 80 hours. Yeah.
That's the hustle.
Man, and you know, it could be mind blowing and it could be very discouraging, but I said, you know what? That's 12 credit hours more that I have to get that associate's than I would have had if I wouldn't have came in. So I changed my mindset.
Okay.
And so I'm going to Joliet Junior College with a house arrest band around my ankle because I got to do 3 years house arrest, 3 years parole. So nobody knew I'm on house arrest or whatnot because I covered up because I'm embarrassed of my past. I'm embarrassed of who I was and whatnot. I'm embarrassed of the things I did. So I'm not telling anyone my past. But at the same time, I know I have to do these things because I want to be able to have regular visits with my sons. I want to encourage them to do something different because they both know I'm in prison at this. I've been in prison, but I want to teach them that prison doesn't define you, because that was the legacy my dad left, because my dad had been in prison for 7 years. So, you know, I know my dad turned around. He taught himself in prison how to be an electrician and got out and got a pardon from the government, from the Trinidad government, and was able to, like, you know, wire the whole jail and the whole courthouse, and they gave him like a pardon. So, and not only that, and throughout his life, he was like an engineer. And once he retired, they gave him an honorary master's degree so he can teach at the university down there. So I kind of thought to myself, man, if he can do it, I can do it too. So I started going to school. I didn't quite fit in. And I was like wandering around like a lost puppy, you know, not really knowing where to go, what to do, how to step that. All I know is that I got this huge criminal record and arrested probably over 20 times for various different types of crimes and whatnot. So now what do I do with that? You know, I have people coming to me like, you know, like, man, why don't you get on your hustle, man? You get on your hustle, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no, because this is not something I want to do. I don't want to go back to prison. This is not something I want to see my sons from the inside of a, you know, glass or from a prison, having them come down there, get frisked, searched and everything when they've done nothing wrong. So I'm like, you know, keeping my mind focused. And then, you know, there would be one or two friends that would really help, that, you know, like, would be like, they honor the fact that, okay, he's not selling drugs or whatnot, but he still needs help, you know. But everybody else, you know, kind of basically turned their back against me, like, you know, turned their back on me. So now I'm going to JJC. I have a little support, not that much, but a little. So one day I met this person who forever changed my life, and her name was Margot Underwood. I'll never forget her. And she was like seeing me, and I was just moping, and I was because I was mad because they were supposed to let me off of house arrest early. And so, you know, I can, once I got off house arrest, I would be able to get weekend visits with my son and stuff like that. And she's like, what's going on? And she's like, you can tell me anything. So I let it all out. Oh. I've been in prison 4 times, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'm on house arrest and nothing's going right. And she's just like, you know, she didn't even bat an eye. And she was like, well, I've seen you around here and you work hard and you deserve another chance. So let's see what we can do to get you another chance. Do you know this lady got on a phone call, was calling up the parole office and advocating for me. And she kept advocating until she got in touch with someone, got in touch with my parole agent. And she, because of her, she helped me get involved in the school. She brought me on, and, you know, we formed a little organization that would help assist students, helping get them internships and different things like that. It was like the Psychology Social Services Resource Network. They made me the vice president. And, you know, for the first time, I was like, man, I'm part of something, and it feels good. Like, I used to be in prison dreaming about fun, like, oh, that would be cool to do a fundraiser. I'm doing fundraiser now. I was like, man, I can't believe I'm really part of this. And the more she acclimates me into the school and she starts like drawing attention from other people in the school. Now, you know, when I didn't have any of that support, now other people are supporting me because of her, you know, because she took it on. You know, they started, you know, basically when she highlight all the things that I've done being there at JJC, other people started noticing. Then she went to her and her whole entire family, her son, her daughter, and her husband. They went to the chief of the police and was like, Andre's having a very hard time. And they gave them all the reasons why he should help me. And so he was like, okay, well, we'll see what we can do. Well, a couple weeks later, everybody thought he lost his mind because he had me working for the Joliet Junior College Police Department as one of their motor assist unit, you know, almost like a security, like security type, junior security type position.
Right, that's dope.
Until then, I didn't have any money coming in or whatever, just student loans and whatever, you know. And so they gave me a job. Another organization gave me a job tutoring called Project Achieve. They gave me a job as well. You know, and it all started from Margot Underwood. And she took me to the career, one of the career resource networks there. And this other woman, Bridget Larkin, she was trying diligently to get me a job. But things, you know, they hooked me up with another job on campus where I was working with a visually impaired student and helping him take notes. So everything there kind of took root. And even with her involvement, another person named Todd Bird and Chief Commander, they kind of set the path in motion for everyone to take notice of me. Like, you know, the president of the college, the vice president, they would speak to me, they would treat me like I was a normal human being. People started embracing me. And I could, you know, remember just walking around campus feeling really good and feeling like I was standing for something. And I remember I got my first chance to advocate for someone that was locked up because it was this kid I knew that was locked up. He was big and he wanted to be on the football team. And he was like, man, they won't let me on the football team because I've been to prison. And I went to the coach and I talked to the coach and I advocated for him. And the coach said, man, you know, have you ever advocated for anyone before? And I was like, nah, this is the first time. He was like, man, you did such a fantastic job. I'm going to let this young man get on the team. He's going to practice this year. And next year, as long as he continues to do good, he's going to be good. He's going to go ahead and be on the team. It didn't work out because he ended up going back to prison. But I tried, and I did succeed. So it let me know, you know, it still made me feel good. And, you know, so it kind of set my tone of what I wanted to do. I wanted to be of help and help out people and whatnot. So I became like a mentor on campus and mentoring other college students. And what was so good about that, no one looked at my background. No one looked at me and said, okay, this guy's been to prison. He doesn't deserve a chance. And, you know, I was able to do a lot of things that I never thought or I never dared dream. Because I remember the chief of the police department, he said, what do you want to do, Andre? I said, well, I can't do a lot of things. He said, well, let's not focus on what you can't do. Let's focus on what you can do. And that changed my perception in itself. And working for the Joliet Junior College Police Department, working with the different clubs and organizations at JJC, Latino Resource Center, there at JJC, and just working with different organizations at JJC kind of set a tone. So, like, by the time I graduated, I was just like, man, you know, everyone kind of knew me. Everyone supported me. And so now I graduate. What do? I come here to NIU because I felt it and I felt something draw me here. So now what do? What do I want to major in? And I started learning. I was like, well, you know, I love psychology. I love sociology. Those are my favorite classes. So I started double major, psychology, sociology, but I gravitated to sociology, but I still love psychology. What drew me to them is like, because I wanted to find out why I did the things I did and why my peers did the things they did, why we were subjected to incarceration, why other people our age were subjected to college and different opportunities. Why were we facing all these different things? you know, when other people did not have these same breaks and whatnot, you know, were not faced with poverty, crime, you know, violence. You know, I wanted to find all these things out because I knew once I found these things out, things would make sense.
I had over 30 questions.
No.
Right? No, but listen.
Sorry.
I wanted you to be able to tell your story completely and in whole because somebody needs to hear what you went through.
Right.
Your life experiences and how it affected you and the course it took you on and you coming back and thinking, I can do this better instead of thinking, man, I ain't doing that shit no more.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse my language. But you know what? I can do this better. And it kept setting you back and setting you back. And then when you got it, you said you were in your 30s. And you said, look, now I'm going to do this way. And it took you along a certain path. And then certain people started to become drawn to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it became maybe easier. You didn't say it was easy, but I imagine the more people that became drawn to you and the more you put your mind to it and your workability to it and you put that action behind it and that faith in it and God blessed it,
yes,
you became what you decided to be and everything became easier. To where you're here now, first year doctoral student.
Yes.
Right? Everybody needs to hear that. So those questions didn't matter.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? What I'm saying?
Right.
Those questions didn't matter.
Okay.
Now for the young man, grown man,
right,
who hears this, what can they do today?
No, I think first and foremost, education has made a great impact on my life.
Mm-hmm.
I would say counseling had made a great impact on my life because we all know, like, when things aren't right, when things aren't, you know, how life isn't how it should be or how it's supposed to be, we know these things, but sometimes we do nothing about it. So when I went to counseling, I was able to focus on areas and I was able to think, even though it took a while to take form, that seed they planted, you know, and helped me look at the things that I wanted to change. It took a while. And when it started blooming, I couldn't stop it. Well, I know I need to do this. I need to do that. So I would say what took me down the path, what opened my eyes was education. You know, you're not going to get far without education and educating yourself. And I'm not talking about going and, you know, like getting a bachelor's or a master's degree isn't for everyone, but educating yourself in whatever field you want or you wish to work to. You know, whether you're getting vocational training and you want to be a carpenter or you want to be an electrician, you know, that's education. And education is powerful.
Right.
And it can take you places you never even dreamed of or open your eyes to other worldviews and other perspectives that you never even thought of and even question why you did the things you did and why you had to do the things you do, and why not change?
Let's go back to the counseling piece. You know, in the Black community, especially among Black men, we're not trying to get counseling. You know what I mean? I got counseling for the first time after my mother passed in 2013. And it did help. It was something I was like, man, telling nobody I'm doing this, right?
Right.
But it is very helpful. How can it be beneficial to other young men and adults as well?
Well, you know, of course, you know, the Black population is very, there's been so much oppression in the overall systematic oppression. So, like, we don't trust any type of government institutions or whatnot.
Rightfully so, for the most part.
But what we need to realize is not all institutions are there to see us fail. some are there to help us succeed. So what helped me was, like, I had a reason to live. I had a reason to change my life. And finding that reason within yourself to make these changes. So counseling gave me, like, you know, gave me a foundation of, like, okay, I know I want to change, but how do I go about doing this? Because many of us, we have these ideas, like, okay, I'll change in this course of time, or I'll wait for this so I can change. You know, counseling kind of helped me, because I had the answers myself, but I was either too scared or I didn't realize I had these answers. So counseling helped me to find, seek out, and carry through with everything I knew I had. And, you know, it gave me a focal point on where I wanted to start. So, you know, for the person who wants to make changes, whether, you know, they're black, brown, white, whatever, if they're going through changes in their lives and whatnot, I say counseling is a great place to start if you really want to change. And for the most part, I know a lot of people who've been in the same circumstances or similar circumstances I've been in, they want to change. But, you know, there's been so much taboo or stigma about going to counseling. You're crazy and different things like that. But counseling is not all about someone who's mentally impaired. It might be someone who wants to find focus, someone who wants to find that equilibrium that they've been searching for all their life. And that's not through drugs or anything like that, because counseling is not about drugs, you know. And just to be able to look past, you know, those stigmas and the labelizations and everything like that been to play against counseling. If you give it a chance, just give it a chance, you will see how tremendous and how beneficial it can be. You know, I never knew how beneficial it was until I went through the counseling program.
I actually can agree with that 100%. You carry things with you, and you get used to carrying things
mm-hmm.
that you don't realize is weighing you down, and it's because you don't realize or know how to let them go. Sometimes it hurts to let them go. Let's do this,
mm-hmm.
because I want to get further into what we see going on
right.
With black males, black youth, and how to get them right, back on the right course, dealing with what we see going on with policing and society. And you have two strong opposing viewpoints about that. How do we deal with that? So that means you're going to have to put your counseling hat on. But what I like to do is invite you back next week, because I want to give you an hour and a half next week to talk about that.
Okay.
So we won't give them too much this week, and we can bring you back next week. Is that okay with you?
Sounds good to me.
All right. So yeah. If you enjoyed this like I enjoyed this, please tune in again next Tuesday for my man Andre. And you play this one back. It's very powerful. And then next week what we'll do is we'll go deeper into dealing with the problems we see going on today in society and some remedies for that. So you guys stay tuned, and we'll be back next Tuesday.